Welcome to the Strategic Investor. Join us as we interview some of the world's most productive asset managers and uncover sophisticated and unique investment strategies in the markets. Here is your host, Charlie Wright.
Hello and welcome to Strategic Investor Radio on OC Talk Radio, where we bring you investment strategies you are not hearing elsewhere. We'd like to welcome as our guest today, Andrew Manton, Portfolio Manager for Shelton International Select Equity Strategy, headquartered out of Denver, but Andy works out of Greenwich, Connecticut. Andy, welcome to Strategic Investor Radio.
Well, thank you, Charlie. Good to be here.
So, Andy, you've got an MBA out of University of Illinois out of Chicago. Before that, a bachelor's degree from Carnegie Mellon. You've been in the investment management business for many years at various firms, typically focused on international companies, and you have developed a unique analysis methodology identifying stages in corporate life cycle similar to the market life cycles that others have talked about. So first, let's open with a brief background of yours and Shelton Capital Management here, Andy.
Sure, Charlie. I guess first I would just correct you in the colleges. So I went to University of Illinois for my bachelor's and Carnegie Mellon for my MBA.
Oh, my apologies. Well, it's on your website here. So, it's easy to get confused on websites here, Andy. So
sure.
Thank you for clarifying that.
Yeah, no problem. So I work for a firm called Shelton Capital. We are more on the small side, I would say. We have about $2 billion in assets under management. We're based in Denver, and we've got offices here in Greenwich, and also in San Francisco. Before that, I was at I started off out of Carnegie Mellon at Deutsche Asset Management, and was there for a little while, and then went to a company called Victory Capital for a little while, and then ended up here at Shelton. So I've been running the strategy for 10 years now, and it's been the same process throughout that whole time frame.
Okay, so tell us a little about your corporate life cycle method of analysis. I have not seen that elsewhere. I presume this is completely proprietary. We have seen that kind of thing again in markets, that markets go through various phases, but I haven't seen it for corporations. So tell us about it.
Sure. Well, it's basically trying to get at the heart of what investors are looking for in a company, and that's trying to measure how successful a company is at redeploying its own capital to create value for shareholders. So with that in mind, we went about trying to come up with a way to segment the entire universe. In this case, it's everything in the world, ex-US, in a way that would tell us right up front how successful companies have been, in the last few years anyway, at creating value for shareholders. And basically, that's the whole concept of a corporate life cycle. When you can take two basic measurements like asset growth and then return on invested capital within a company, when you have those two calculations done, you can figure out how good or not good a company is really at creating value for shareholders.
So let me interrupt for a second here. So tell us now. So there, you're talking about a corporate life cycle, okay?
Yes.
So there are how many stages in this life cycle?
We define five different stages within a corporate life cycle. So when you're looking at it, we call it the first stage, innovation, and then expansion, and then what we call deceleration, maturity, and then what we call distress. If you're thinking about an early stage company that's innovating and spending money to create products, oftentimes they're growing their asset base, but they're not quite getting the sales or the returns on their own capital that's going to exceed their cost of capital. So we put that in the first bucket, or innovation.
And so you have these five buckets or five stages, and can you identify, are you very confident and comfortable that the stage you are identifying is actually the stage that they're in? Are there other confirming factors?
Yeah, that part of our process is done quantitatively, and we can definitely quantitatively screen out companies and determine, you know, what stage they're at, or, you know, what stage they've been at over the last 3 years. So that part is not objective in the sense that we're looking at a company and trying to guess. It's definitely a quantitative part of what we do.
Okay, and when you do that, then how do you use that as a factor for investing?
So once we know that, it gives us a pretty good sense for, you know, what we should be looking for in the company's business plan. So everybody, you know, has got their own idea for what they should be doing going forward. But what we want to know is if we've identified a company that's, say, in the expansion phase, that's growing very quickly, what we want to know up front is that there's a plan in place to keep them growing, to keep their returns on their investments growing at a much faster pace than the rest of the market. So we'll look for, very quickly, we'll look for their competition coming into the market. We want to know that they've identified that competition. We're going to look for, you know, just the overall business plan in terms of you know, any signs for complacency. So, you know, the other side of that, of the cycle, in the more mature stages, we're looking for things that are going to, you know, that they've identified to turn around the company. So business plan changes, sometimes executive changes, things that are really going to shake up the, you know, what they've been doing.
Okay, so let me ask a couple of poignant questions here. Let's take two companies, and you tell us how well they fit or didn't fit and why in your system. Let's start with GE. They're falling apart. They've been removed this past week from the Dow Industrials. Their price is at half of what it was, I don't know, year and a half ago. They're selling companies. They're looking at selling more companies. Were they identified as, you know, in the final fifth stage by you guys, or were there reasons why they weren't?
They were. I mean, this hasn't been a quick undoing of the company. It's been somewhat slow, and that, so we've been watching them fall apart for the last couple of years. So yes, it was what we call a distressed company, and that doesn't necessarily mean that they're financially distressed. It just means that they're not creating value for shareholders anymore, in the form of returning more than their cost of capital. Okay. So they were in the distressed bucket, and what we, you know, would have to see from them is that they have identified ways that they can turn that around. And in this case, they are trying to, and they're trying to sell off companies divisions, as you said, and really shaking up the company in that way. And that's typically what you see from a company in that stage.
Okay. So now let's take the opposite of that, Netflix. Their stock price has been going crazy. Where have you had them in these stages, and has that been accurate?
So they're what we call an expansion company. They're which is the second phase, I'd say, of the life cycle. So that's been accurate. You know, they're growing their asset base quite a bit. They're investing heavily for growth, for future growth, and they've been seeing that growth in the form of higher returns. So that was definitely accurate, and that story has been a very good one.
So now you're really focused, however, on international companies, correct?
That's correct.
So a natural question here, Andy, would be, do you know enough about the markets that these different companies are in, from Scandinavia through Northern Europe and Southern Europe and Asia and the like, to be able to really judge in ways that it would be easier to judge if you were only in the U.S.?
Well, I think that comes through a couple of different things. You know, one is experience. You know, I've been looking at you know, the rest of the world for a long time now, and so I've got a sense for many different countries. Not all countries, but many different countries. And you're right. You know, when I look at a company, I definitely have to consider what country they're in, and that country has its own culture, its own corporate culture, its own set of issues and problems. So, you know, the one thing with international investing that people always ask is, well, do you hedge your currency? And the answer to that is no, we do not. And there's several reasons for that. But really, we have to take a stance on what we think the currency is going to do. And with the currency comes, you know, a whole macro view of that country. So we have to be comfortable with you know, the surrounding environment of the company and not just the company itself.
Yeah, I can see that. That you've taken on one heck of a challenge here, Andy. I mean, you've created a new system methodology, really, for analysis, and you don't so you don't really have others to rely on. I presume you you guys, this is your creation, and you guys are the only ones doing this.
To my knowledge, yeah. I mean, I don't know if we came up with this, but we've definitely expanded it in a much much more detailed scientific way, I would say. I mean, it's—I would just say that it's not so different from what other you know investment teams or even other individual investors do, because we're trying to get at the same thing. We just do it in a bit more of a scientific way, I would say.
I'd see. Okay. Yeah. And that makes sense. But then you apply it to international business, and so you've got, as you say, the cultures and the environment of Greece and Germany and Norway and Latin America, Brazil. Oh, my goodness. You've just really taken on a challenge. You must really enjoy this.
I love it. And but you're right. There is a lot to think about. I mean, I've got 40 stocks in my portfolio that I have to always be up to date and following, but I also have, you know, the whole macro environment in all the different countries we invest in to worry about as well. And
right.
Even countries we don't invest in, because so, they do ultimately affect.
So what misperceptions do you see about your system and methodology here by most by investors and advisors here that you have to overcome?
I think that, you know, when I explain the system, sometimes people get a little bit lost in that it sounds a little bit too complex, maybe. But again, I think I have to go back several times and just explain that it's not so different from what we're all trying to achieve, and that it's we're trying to figure out how good companies are at you know, creating value. We just go about it in a little bit different way. So, you know, once I explain that, it seems to set investors' minds a little bit more at ease. But, you know, it does take some explaining, because people want to know naturally about our process, and when they hear that it's a little bit different, there is some worry that, you know, we're doing something completely off the grid here.
They're concerned. So do you do this as a research company and then make this research available? Do you have on your website here various companies and here is where they are in their stage, or do you just use this as analysis factors for selecting the stocks that you're buying for your fund?
Yeah, it's completely proprietary. We don't really publish anything that we do, any research that we do. It's all for our funds, and therefore it's reflected in what we own, but we don't give the information out to anybody.
And to your knowledge, who are the kinds of investors into your funds and strategy here, and why do they invest in it? Well, when I say that, I mean, is it family offices? Is it retail investors? Is it advisors? Is it the institutional marketplace? Who's doing it? What categories of investors?
Well, it's all of that. I'd say the biggest majority right now is definitely we have some in family offices and then larger RIAs. So, but then we have a small contingent of and growing contingent of institutional investors as well. So it definitely appeals more, I think, to the institutional market because it is a bit more of a more complex process. But, you know, the returns prove themselves, I think, and have been for a while. And so the retail market has definitely picked up on it. So.
Are you more focused on the larger developed markets of Europe and Japan, or are you more on emerging markets of China and India and Brazil and Russia, etc.?
Yeah, so we are an all-world ex-U.S. Strategy, and we do have emerging market exposure for sure, but it never really gets above 20%, but it does range. So EMs, as you know, are fickle, and so, you know, we have to definitely watch the weighting in those markets a little bit more than developed markets. But, you know, right now I'd say that We've been taking our emerging markets exposure down over the last month or so. So it's probably more toward 13 or 14% right now. But we can be zero in emerging markets, or we can be as high as 20 in emerging markets. And so it does vary. But emerging markets in general, I would just say, are very it's difficult to label them all as a group. Every company is, or every country is very different nowadays. And, so we do tend to concentrate in only a few countries.
Well, I can certainly understand that with Argentina and Brazil, and then, versus Germany and Sweden and Norway, tremendous differences here. So tell us, let's get just a little bit current here. Typically, we don't like to get too current because we like our podcast to be evergreen and not based upon what's going on in particular markets at the time. But right now, we're in late June 2018, and everybody thinks that the U.S. market is the place to be for political reasons and a variety of others. And so what's your opinion on that?
Yeah, well, I mean, I'd say that... I do get that question quite a bit, actually, is, when we're trying to sell somebody on our, just an international fund in general, some of the pushback is, why would I invest in internationally? I mean, the U.S. has been the best market for a long time, and, we're the best. So why look at internationally? I think that, there's a couple of reasons for that, but one is that some of the best companies are not U.S. companies. In fact, Harvard Review does a study every year. And last year they had, I think that it's the top 100 CEOs that they rate. And, of the top 20, only four of the top 20 were U.S. CEOs. So, you can take away from that, 16 of the top 20 are CEOs that are managing companies outside the U.S. So if you don't look outside the U.S., you're really missing some good opportunities to invest with some great companies. But I think, nowadays... Yes, there's a lot going on in all parts of the world, but there's a lot going on here as well that would make me a little bit uneasy for just staying completely in the U.S. Valuations, for one, I mean, there's certainly a valuation premium in the U.S. It's been like that for a long time, but certainly it's getting to the point where I think it's making investors a little bit uneasy about adding that next dollar into the U.S. market. So that's definitely a couple things that, to consider.
Yeah, well, thank you. And, valuation's a great point. That's a story that I heard a year or two ago that I don't hear as much anymore now that, our prices have gone up, et cetera. But with the political turmoil of Europe, it's a struggle. But we've got our own political turmoil here to deal with. So it's kind of like the pot calling the kettle black here. So on a general sense here, Andy, what would you say is the best advice regarding investing you've ever heard, read, or received?
Well, I think that the best advice I've ever really had, I think hammered into me early on, is that, when you're looking at individual companies, it's don't get too emotionally involved with a company. In other words, we spend a lot of time looking at one company, but you really got to find a way to stay neutral in that, you don't let the time that you spent cloud your judgment. So you have always got to be asking, critical questions of the management team. You can't let, a CEO's charisma, say, cloud your judgment and not being able to read the signals that are coming from the results that the company is producing. So it's being able to stay on top of a company, but not get too emotionally involved that you can't quickly turn around and sell it if you need to.
Yeah, don't marry the stock.
And, correct.
That's a great point, and it's so easy to say. And yet, when it's performed well for you and you'd owned it over the years, et cetera, I'm sure many people have held on to GE longer than one would expect them to because, sure. GE's always been there for me, and my father owned it and all of that kind of thing, So another question.
Real quick, I live in Fairfield, Connecticut, where GE was headquartered for so many years. And, I'll run into the retired GE worker, and, it's heartbreaking to see, what's going on with their long-term holdings of GE. And, I think that's the real shame.
That's right.
Not just the long-term shareholders in general, but it's the ones that have worked there and, you know, put their life into the company.
They have. And there was an article in the Wall Street Journal probably, I don't know, a month or two ago on that very subject. They took GE and the depressed stock price has just really hurt a lot of people, and some of them had to go back to work because they had such a large portion of their retirement savings in GE. And why wouldn't they? Because, you know, it had always been such a great company, strong, et cetera. So, it's got to be tough to see those people. Question we'd like to ask all of our guests here. Andy, what keeps you awake at night?
Well, I think several things. I mean, the good thing about, I'd say, what I do is that I don't really feel, I'm not all that worried about the companies that I own. I think that I know so much about them that I'm not up at night worrying about what my portfolio is going to do the next day. I think what I tend to think more about is something we talked about a little earlier. It's more of the macro nature of international investing, and I tend to think about what's going on with different countries, and I think specifically what I'm worried about these days is I think just debt overall, and specifically Japan, China, and even in the U.S. I think that debt levels have gotten to a pretty worrying point. I think if you look at Japan, I mean, nobody talks about this anymore, but the demographic shift in Japan is happening so quickly that it's really starting to have a huge effect on the workforce, but on the pensions in general. And, you know, what we've seen there over the last few years is Abenomics, you know, has not worked. They're trying to grow their way out of all the problems that they're having, which is low growth, you know, low GDP growth and deflationary pressures. And this is just not working. They're trying to implement a sales tax over there that they desperately need, but they can't. You know, Abe's pretty worried about the effects that's going to have on the economy, and rightly so. But they need the revenue. You know, they have huge debt levels, public debt of close to 250% of GDP, total debt over 400% of GDP. Such huge leverage, I would say, you know, makes them hugely sensitive to small increases in interest rates, which are already, as you know, extremely low. And as the population shifts, which it's doing rapidly now, I'd say, and the pensions start to bleed out, and the risks of interest rates increasing over time is growing, I'd say.
You know, Andy, that is certainly something worthy of worry. Not a lot of subjects are worthy of worry, but that is one, and I would say I agree 100% with everything that you just said. I heard the other day, can't confirm and verify it, but I heard it by, I don't recall exactly who, but a reputable source, that in Japan, they sell more diapers for adults than they do for children, for babies. Okay,
yeah.
Because it just tells you right there. The demographics are not in their favor. They have these huge loans. We have debt, or we do too, but, you know, not nearly to the degree that they have. And Europe has also. And yet Europe has this negative interest rate policy. And we're not talking about a sustainable situation here. Several years ago, I don't know, 5-7 years ago or something, I read the book, The Great Deformation, by David Stockman, who was Ronald Reagan's budget guy. And he said, we are built on debt. He was talking about the U.S. primarily. We are built on debt. And you can only do that for so long. Just like the people who wrote the book This Time, It's Different. You know, the Harvard researchers. You can only grow through debt for so long. And then at some point, you're going to pay a price, and it's not going to be pretty. So keep worrying about that subject, will you, Andy? It's worthy of worry. The last question is, what book on investing would you recommend for our listeners, as we always ask?
Ooh. As an international investor, I have to worry, again, about different subjects. So I'm always curious about reading about different cultures and different things that are going on in the world on a more macro level. So there's a book I'm reading right now by Rushir Sharma. He's the head of EM at Morgan Stanley. He wrote a book, a few years ago, that was pretty successful. And he just recently wrote another book, I think last year, called The Rise and Fall of Nations. But I just picked it up recently, and it's a great book. It's about basically trying to determine which countries are going to be the successful ones going forward. Rushier is he travels all the time, so he has a great sense of, you know, for what's going on out there, you know, especially in emerging markets. But he's been very critical about many different emerging markets, specifically India and China. So he pointed out, you know, many things about what's going on in those countries that nobody's really talking about. So,
Andy, that is an excellent recommendation. We have not had that before. Tell us the author again.
Rushier Sharma.
Sharma.
Yep. Yeah, Rushier is Rucchir.
Hey, thank you very much for that. Really appreciate it. So for those who would like to know more, where can they go?
The website is sheltoncap.com, and that's probably the easiest place to go. And, you know, my information's on there. Our sales representative's information is on there as well.
And for somebody who would like a familiar voice to kind of reach out to, your contact information?
Yeah, you can honestly call me directly. My office number is 646-335-2321.
Okay. Hey, well, thank you very much for joining us. Final words for our listeners here, Andy.
Well, I think that international investing is nothing to be scared about. I think that the best companies that I've run into over my experience investing money has been finding companies in outside the U.S. So I think that once you start looking outside the U.S., it's a big world out there. So feel free to call me if you have any questions about international investing in general or just about what we do.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for taking time out to talk to us, Andy, and our best wishes to you and to Shelton Capital Management to continue to be successful here. Thank you for joining
us. Thanks, Charlie. Appreciate it.
Again, we've been talking with Andy Manton, Portfolio Manager for Shelton International Select Equity Strategy. You've been listening to Strategic Investor Radio on OC Talk Radio. We'd love to have you contact us at info@strategicinvestorradio.com. Go to our website to hear podcasts of all of our interviews and shows. I'm Charlie Wright. Appreciate you being here. Wishing you an enjoyable week and productive investing.
Strategic Investor Radio is a production of OC Talk Radio and is provided for educational purposes only. Content of this program and the views of the guests should not be considered as recommendations by OC Talk Radio or investment advice from the host Charlie Wright or any other entity attached to this production. Investors should always consult qualified financial, investment, tax, or legal professionals prior to investing.